Thank you, and thank you very much for the invitation to take part in today's discussion. One of the great fallacies that people often discuss in connection with goodness, morality, is the fallacy that when you know what to do, you can do it. But the key to virtue is knowledge. It doesn't take very much observation to remind us that that doesn't work quite as straightforwardly as it sounds. Yet, it's important that we recognise that our talk about goodness has a very deep connection with our talk about perception. What we see shapes how we are, to put it very simply. And I want to begin this morning by saying a little bit about that in slightly more detail. What do we see? And how do we see it? What's the range of our vision? What are the things we habitually allow to drop off the edge of our vision? How far do we see in the field of our vision things in terms of ourselves and our own agenda? Because so much of what goes wrong in our experience has something to do either with what we train ourselves to ignore. And training ourselves to ignore is one of those features of the moral life which is sadly rather focal to understanding a lot of this. Either what we train ourselves to ignore or what we insist on seeing simply, exclusively, in terms of our own needs, our own agendas. And so I want to begin rather schematically by saying that one way into thinking about and discussing the good life is asking, what are the factors which encourage us to ignore aspects of our field of perception? What are the factors that push us towards determining and constructing things around us simply in relation to our own agenda? Because without some liberation from both of those, our lives continue to be shrunk, diminished, damaged, and therefore damaging to others. I begin with that partly because of the tradition that I come from, a theological tradition in which between, say, about 400 and 700 of the Christian era, a series of writers on the spiritual life in the Middle East produced a fairly sophisticated and extensive set of tools for diagnosis of faulty seeing. The writers of this era were fascinated by the ways in which what they call our passions interfere with our perception. What they meant by passions, it's hard to sum up briefly, but perhaps the best way of understanding that is that for them, passions are instincts that have not been thought through. An unthought instinct continually pulls us back within the framework that I started by outlining, that framework of ignoring or constructing on our own terms. One of the writers of this period, a man called Evagrius, goes so far as to say that there's a difference between what he calls diabolical knowledge and angelic knowledge of the world. Diabolical knowledge of the world is seeking to know what's there simply in terms of what immediately meets my need, as I constructed at that moment. Diabolical knowledge, therefore, absorbs what's outside into myself. Angelic knowledge is seeing what is there in relation to God. And whether one approaches this as a religious believer or not, I think it's possible to see that angelic knowledge can be understood as seeing things as having dimensions that are utterly irrelevant to us. Angelic knowledge of the world is seeing that the world does not exist for me. Diabolical knowledge is seeing the world as entirely oriented to myself. And, predictably, Evagrius says, human knowledge is unfortunately wobbling wildly between those two extremes all the time. And what we need is a clear set of diagnostic tools about what pulls us towards diabolical knowledge, what liberates us for something a little more like angelic knowledge. That is to say, what allows us to, in turn, allow the world to be the world, to recognize the dimensions that are not about us or serving us, to acknowledge that what we see and who we see is shaped by relationships and factors outside our own personal agenda. It's out of that kind of model that the familiar trope of the deadly sins is introduced. The tradition of the seven deadly sins in Western Christianity is in fact a rather crude version of the eight passions of the soul in Eastern Christianity, and you can see immediately what a difference there is. Not seven deadly sins, but eight ways of things going wrong. Eight varieties of inner pathology. And I won't go through them in detail, but if you look at the analysis given in the 4th, 5th, 6th century of the passions of the soul, you'll see that, for example, they are understanding greed, or pride, or self-promotion, or anger, not simply as bad emotions, but as instincts which need to be understood, lived through, looked at, prayed through, and integrated. What you don't want to do in this framework is try to deny them or sit on them. What you do need to do is look clearly at them. And so the classic treatises in the Greek spiritual tradition on the passions of the soul are simply an attempt to look clearly at these various ways in which things can go wrong, in which instinct, unexamined, blocks our vision. I was delighted to discover in one fifth century work by a man with the unwelcoming name of Mark the Ascetic, a very vivid description of what goes wrong and how unexamined instinct, pure reactivity, prevents us from a good life, either in the sense of feeling at home with ourselves and our environment, or in the sense of being actively benevolent. Here's what goes wrong. Pardon the gender-exclusive language, it is still the 5th century. He who does not understand God's judgments walks on a ridge like a knife edge and is easily unbalanced by every puff of wind. When praised, he exalts. When criticized, he is bitter. When he feasts, he makes a pig of himself. When he suffers hardship, he moans and groans. When he understands, he shows off. And when he does not understand, he pretends that he does. When rich, he is boastful. When in poverty, he plays the hypocrite. Gorged, he grows brazen. And when he fasts, he becomes arrogant. He quarrels with those who reprove him. And those who forgive him, he regards as fools. It's a fine description of a certain number of public figures one can think of. Also, of course, even more uncomfortably of oneself. But I quote it as a summary of not so much evil doing as pathologized perception. The person who cannot see what there is, in relating all things to herself or himself, becomes locked into a selfhood constructed in very strict and careful opposition to and exclusion of a human environment which might challenge, enlarge, heal even. And that's where I want to say we have been thinking about the good life, to connect our notions of goodness with, as the great Simone Weil would have said, our notions of attention. The good life is an attentive life. That's to say, one capable of attunement to and response, honest and apt response to the habitat we're in, which carries with it an awareness of the actual need, the actual invitation offered by the human neighbour. And in that sense, the good life requires us to talk about art and intellect as much as anything else. The disciplines of intellect and imagination are essentially disciplines of attention. Once again, Simone Weil's wonderful essay on the spiritual significance of school studies underlines the way in which the sheer, unremitting discipline of what's there, which the intellect has to cope with, is simply one way of decentering our obsessive, self-serving habit. Or, to put it rather more simply, in a phrase which I associate with the novelist T.H. White, the best cure for being miserable is to learn something. Art, intellect, the disciplines of attention. Because our goodness, in every sense, our at-homeness in our environment, as well as our fruitful relation with others, depends on challenging ignorance and fantasy. Ignorance and fantasy are pushed back to the degree that we learn attention. But of course, one aspect of learning attention is also learning to be where we are. One way in which we can fail to be attentive is constantly fidgeting to find the perspective that suits us best, rather than waiting patiently within the space we actually occupy. That can be literal or metaphorical. Metaphorically, we fidget by looking for the self-image and the image of others that apparently fits best. We shuffle around between perspectives. And while there's a role for play here, trying out other perspectives, if we don't have some, what another great 20th century philosopher calls, zero point of orientation, we will be inattentive. And so to see clearly requires us to be somewhere. Years ago, a friend of mine who was a noted sculptor said that the reason he felt uneasy in airport lounges was the sense of not being anywhere in particular. He said he believed this was part of a sinister conspiracy to get us ready for living in outer space. But the sense of being nowhere in particular is one which, in various ways, affects and afflicts us, limits and threatens us. I'm certainly not talking about blood and soil here. I'm talking about what is involved in finding a habitat, a place from which we can see. And some of you will know the anthropological studies that have spoken about the need for both refuge and prospect as the balance within which we live as human beings. The hinterland from which we come, the horizon which we are able to scan, living on the frontier between those is mature perceiving. So we need an anchorage, a point of orientation that's not shifting all the time, which means an understanding of our identity in terms of our body, our literal habitat, our relations. And in the rest of the time given to me, I want to say a little bit about some of the things that make for constructive or generative ways of finding such anchorage. I've spoken in other contexts about the work of that very remarkable therapist, Phoebe Caldwell, who's writing a reflection on her work with young people on the autistic spectrum, has all kinds of large and generative implications. As she sees the challenge of working with such young people, the challenge is that the person on the autistic spectrum frequently lacks a dependable other. Part of the term, the experience of many on the autistic spectrum, is of course the sense of an unreliable, unpredictable environment, a habitat that's out of control. Within that, a dependable human presence, capable of resonating with and echoing back the rhythms that the autistic person senses or works with, becomes a healing and opening factor. And reading Phoebe's work was one of the things which made me reflect at some length on the way in which our secure identities depend on that notion of a dependable other. We literally can't simply depend on ourselves. Who am I? All I have to do is look inside. Well, no, actually. But how then is our identity shaped in dependable relationship? Something about the very definition of our spiritual existence, in the widest possible sense, must, I think, have to do with that confidence that my rhythm is echoed, my speech is understood, my face is seen, that I am, in some sense, read, R-E-A-D, not just reading. So one aspect of finding anchorage, finding an inhabitable habitat, is that search for the dependable other. That's something which we all engage in at different levels in personal relation. It's something which, with all its ambiguities and complications, the therapist is discovering and enacting. Something which bears very heavily on how a religious believer understands the divine. But wherever on that particular map we find ourselves, we are reminded that to be recognized, is one of those things which makes for the good life, simply in the sense that it lifts from me the burden of making myself up or working desperately for a recognition that I can't take for granted. I spoke of how the elements of being somewhere included memory as well as that sense of dependable otherness, the dependable presence. And to speak of memory as bound up with identity is, I'm sure, a theme which doesn't need underlining in this particular company. But last week, I was taking part in an event at St. Paul's Cathedral, along with someone who's spent many years working on issues around dementia, asking the question, can we still speak of identity when memory is being dissolved? His answer was, we can and we must, because even our most intimate memories are not just our possession, but in some sense part of a history that we share. A healthy community, he argued, is one which helped hold the memories of individuals within it, even when they themselves were not sure where they were, which once again provided a dependable environment where the past was not just something fragile that had to be held onto so that identity was completely lost when it disappeared, but that there was a holding of a whole identity by others, by a community, as as well as by the self. Memory is deeply connected with the stories I tell, of course, the stories we tell. But sometimes it's important that others tell our story back to us in one way or another, reminding us that it's not simply our own fragile possession. That connects a little bit with the way in which, again, one of the ways of relating to those living with dementia is quite often to find the buried or the forgotten rhythms, narratives, literally words, and forms of words that have embedded themselves in bringing them to light again, which is why, of course, so many of those living with dementia are woken almost literally by music, by familiar phrases from an earlier phase of their life, by the use of a language that they knew in childhood and haven't used since. I think of Oliver Sacks's great work on awakenings, but I think those experiences are common to anyone who has ever sat with Dame Leth, someone whose memory has apparently gone, discovering the possibility of awakening as a memory is played back to them, mirrored back to them, so that they can, for a moment, realize they have a refuge, they have a hinterland. They are not simply out under an empty sky. So, memory, along with the presence of the dependable other, becomes part of that anchorage, the place between refuge and prospect. It becomes a way of inhabiting where we are, which leads to some thought about habitat in general. Increasingly, I must say, I find habitat a useful word for describing where we are, internal and external habitat, the furniture of mind and memory, the furniture of a personal world, knowing where I live, in every sense, at every level. Because to have a habitat is not only to know where I live, it's also to know where I can safely invite others. So, in that, I would say our inner habitat, the sense of inner furniture, our outer environment, belong quite closely together. And it shouldn't surprise us that disturbance in an outer habitat has implications for our inner habitat. And it shouldn't surprise us that that appears to apply to the human race in general, not just to the individual. In other words, we might reasonably expect profound ecological disturbance to produce and intensify profound social and psychic disturbance. And I don't think it takes too much imagination to see that as part of our global challenge just at the moment. Ecology is a very helpful word, just like habitat, for thinking about both the internal and the external. Ecology, which is a set of interweaving balances, energies in some sort of equilibrium, which we may disturb without fully noticing it or understanding the implications of what we're doing. And I think that takes us back to those spiritual analyses I began with, in a sense, to the awareness of the ways in which habits of faulty or self-oriented seeing may have far more wide-reaching consequences than we initially imagine. It's not too difficult to upset an inner ecology just as much as an outer. And if you want to apply the image of habitat internally as well as externally, I find I'm rather attracted by the image of a garden as a model. The gardening whereby we both care for and elaborate and develop the balance of our habitat. That's not a million miles away from what we seek to do, I suggest, with our inner habitat, with our inner ecology. There's a rather formidable and not easily readable 18th century spiritual collection called The Garden of the Soul, which may be known to some of you. And although I'm not sure that that's quite how I'd approach it, I like the image that what is within us is something to be guarded, something whose ecology needs to be cared for, sustained, and also developed and elaborated. Not frozen, not curated in a museum, but cared for in a sense that brings out the possibilities of fresh rhythm, fresh reflection, generativity. So, back for a moment to my earlier subject. I've tried thus far to speak about the way in which the good life is very deeply about what we see and what we refuse to see. I try to reflect a little bit on how all this talk about seeing requires us to have a fairly robust notion of our habitat, where we are, being somewhere rather than anywhere. So that to move towards something we can call a good life is to move towards what the Greek tradition calls very unhelpfully apatheia, which is not apathy, but the state where we are not purely reactive, we're not living out of unexamined instinct all the time, but are in some sense unifying our thinking and our feeling, or as the texts will have it, bringing the mind into the heart. That's not a sentimental reduction of intellect to feeling. And the heart here is not just raw emotion. More a matter of asking, how do we learn to respond to our environment with an inseparable intelligence and charity? An inseparable intelligence and charity. An intelligence that's capable of seeing things as they are, not just in relation to us. A charity which assumes that the relation between me and my environment is one of constant giving and receiving, constant life-giving reciprocity. That's apatheia. That's the freedom in regard to passion, which the spiritual tradition looks to. And those of you who know other religious traditions will recognize, I think, the deep resonances here with what Buddhists would say about understanding the twin issues of acquisitiveness and aversion, and how to live with an awareness of those and a poise between those two things, so that what is around us is allowed to be what it is. All of this, as I've said, is not simply about looking after ourselves, except in the sense that the self we might want to look after turns out to be something rather different from the fragile, fretful, and greedy myth that we assume it is. The self we are looking after is the self that lives within its ecology, that knows how to give and receive, that is capable of attunement to the world it's in. And that's why, as I said earlier, there is a genuinely moral aspect to the life of the intellect and the population. I don't want to get into a lengthy polemic about the state of higher education in the United Kingdom. Why not? But it does seem to me that our obsessively functionalist approach to education at every level, including university education, is increasingly making us incapable of understanding what the intellect really is. Intellect is not problem solving. Problem solving is a small streak of that. But intellect as attunement, even, dare I say, joyful attunement to reality, which bears fruit in lives that appear worthwhile. Where's that got to in our discussions about education? I remember writing a couple of years ago about what was then the Green Paper on Higher Education, saying that in page after page, what I'm sorry to say I described as Dalek-infected prose, one word that was conspicuously absent was joy. That intellect is something to do with joy is, again, a moral insight. Because when we understand that our life is in that kind of attunement to what is real, certain levels of denial, fear, and self-protection drop away. A goodness that is worth taking seriously, a goodness which is about fruitful, generative relationship with all that's around me, human and non-human, if it's to last, if it's to be something other than what we call box-ticking, requires that anchorage in joy, in the sense of being at home. Such a sense of being at home is compatible with, Lord knows, any number of varieties of challenge, suffering, and loss. I'm not trying to be Pollyanna-ish about this. Yet without the sense that there is a fundamental place to be that is secure, and that from there clear perception is possible, we are in trouble. You don't need me to elaborate the ways in which socially, psychologically, we constantly appear to get this wrong, or ignore it, fail to ask the right questions. But just to wind up what I wanted to say in these introductory remarks, I'm trying, I suppose, to hold together those two aspects of the words of good life that we need in order to avoid either indulgent individualism or anxious activism. A good life is one where we know ourselves to be in some sense at home in our habitat. But one of the marks of that at-homeness is that we do not react with hostile, destructive panic to other persons or to any other aspects of our environment. Hostile, destructive panic is what creates evil in our world. That vortex of negativity, which increasingly and compulsively shrinks and shrinks and shrinks our world to the dimensions of the unfortunate person so vividly described by Mark the Ascetic, walking on a ridge like a knife edge, unbalanced by every puff of wind. We can all of us acknowledge, recognize that insecurity within ourselves. The challenge is not to get rid of it, but to understand it. By understanding it, to open ourselves to whatever it is in our habitat that secures us, promises us, opens life for us. We live towards a growing clarity of seeing, which is not obsessed with the need to control the habitat. And that means, of course, that the good life is, in some important sense, a life capable of surviving levels of irresolution, a uncertainty, and vulnerability. The good life is not a comfortable life, whoever said it was. It is a life which can be honest about its own fragility, because it knows something about where it lives. So it's that life, I believe, which we're seeking to discuss and understand a bit more deeply in our conversations today. To look deeply into an understanding of it is necessarily to look realistically and candidly at the habits which take us back towards destructive, hostile anxiety, panic. It's to look towards the freedom that attention gives. To paraphrase words which some of us say routinely every morning, a reality whose service is perfect freedom.